Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Jim was very kind to mention my new book, Exorbitant Privilege, which the publisher, Oxford University Press, is promoting as a trade book, as a book for the masses. So one of the implications of that is that they call me from time to time and they ask me to do local radio, drive time radio, to talk about the book. That is, how should I put it, an interesting experience, but it is an opportunity to really tap into, get a sense of what the public is thinking and what they're thinking about my topic or the topic of my book, the Past and Future of the Dollar, in particular. And I have been impressed. It came as something of a surprise to me, although it may not come as a surprise to you. The pervasive sense of angst about the dollar that is out there. There is an awful lot of talk about the Fed, I should put the word in quotes, debasing the dollar. There is an awful lot of worry and anxiety about inflation somewhere beyond the horizon, because core inflation at the moment is nowhere to be seen. People point to the high price of gold, the fact that gold has broken through $1,500 now, as another indication that there is, how should I put it, less than full confidence in the dollar. I don't want to play a dismal scientist this morning. The bright side, if you will, is that the other currencies like the euro have even more serious problems of their own. And there is also the fact that the dollar has the exorbitant privilege. My title, but the phrase comes from a one-time finance minister, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, that it's not only America's currency, but the world's. So it's this last fact that I really want to impress upon you, the remarkable extent to which the dollar is used, not only in the United States, but globally. The dollar is currently used, we learned from the Bank for International Settlements, which does surveys once every 3 years. We learned a couple of months ago. The dollar is currently used in fully 85% of all foreign exchange transactions worldwide. The dollar accounts for 61% of the identified foreign exchange reserves of central banks and governments globally, despite the fact that the United States is now only something on the order of 20% of the global economy. Countries like South Korea and Chile set the prices of more than 80% of their trade in dollars, despite the fact that only some 20% of their exports go to the United States. I give some other examples of this phenomenon in the book. When Somali pirates ransom a ship, they demand that the ransom money be parachuted to them in dollars. When Iran gives President Karzai's people bags full of money, the money in question is presumably dollars. So this fact is a considerable convenience, a competitive advantage for American banks and firms, because they can do their international business in their own currency without having to incur the costs of exchanging dollars for other people's money, without having to bear or hedge the risk that the exchange rate might move against them while the transaction is underway. I would argue that, in fact, the dollar's exorbitant privilege is not an unmixed blessing for the United States, since foreigners want our dollars because they're convenient for their own international transactions, because they are valuable as a form of insurance. They provide liquidity when things go wrong in financial markets. Foreigners are willing to lend to us more freely and at lower interest rates than they would otherwise. If we in the United States fall prey to financial excesses, if we engage in frenzied real estate speculation, for example. Foreigners give us more rope with which to hang ourselves. They did so prior to 2006 by purchasing U.S. Treasury securities, which were close substitutes for the securities of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. So I want to try to understand this situation a little bit better by looking back at its history. How did we get into how did we arrive at this peculiar state of affairs? And then to look to the future and ask whether the dollar will remain the world's currency, and if not, what comes next, and whether we should worry. So how did we get into this situation? The dollar essentially achieved its position of dominance in two stages, one after World War I and a second, perhaps the more important one, after World War II, when the United States was the only economy standing. We were not just the dominant industrial power, we were the far and away the world's leading exporter, and only the United States had deep and liquid financial markets open to the rest of the world. So all of this made it logical and indeed highly attractive for companies and central banks around the world to do their international business in dollars. You will know what has unfolded in the course of the subsequent half century, that there was the post-war recovery of Europe, the miracle growth of Japan, and most recently the emergence of emerging markets. So the United States is less important globally than it was in the immediate aftermath of World War II. But while there has been a relative decline in the size of the U.S. economy, there has been no commensurate decline in the international role of the dollar. The conventional explanation for that is the advantages of incumbency. Incumbency is, normally at least, an advantage for a politician in holding on to public office. Similarly, I would argue incumbency is an advantage for a currency in holding on to its international role. So for importers and exporters, think of an exporter seeking to break into international markets, quoting prices in the same currency that other exporters quote their prices in is a way to avoid confusing your customers. If you have an attractive, competitively priced product, you want to signal that by pricing it in the most transparent way, which means currently in dollars, because everyone else is quoting prices in dollars. It makes sense for you to do the same and to continue doing so. With everyone else buying, selling, and holding dollars, it similarly pays for you to buy, sell, and hold dollars. Economists have a technical term for this phenomenon. They refer to this kind of situation as one characterized by network externalities, where it pays to adopt the same standard as everyone else in your network. And I think it's easy to understand intuitively that situations characterized by network externalities are also characterized by high levels of persistence. Once a practice or a standard is widely adopted, it tends to get locked in. At least that's the argument. I would now like to suggest that this presumption is no longer valid. The notion that importers and exporters and bond underwriters all want to use the same unit as other importers, exporters, and bond underwriters in order to avoid confusing their customers holds less weight in a world when everybody carries in their pocket a device called a smartphone that can be used to compare currency values in real time. Once upon a time, comparing prices in dollars and, say, euros may have been beyond the capacity of all but the sophisticated trader and investor, but this is no longer true now that Currency Converter is one of the 10 most downloaded apps at the Apple App Store. So even if once upon a time the costs of switching and interchangeability were high, I would argue this is no longer the case. Once upon a time, it was said there was only room for one standard, one operating system for personal computers. That was Windows. You had to use Windows because all your colleagues and coworkers used Windows. If you were a dedicated computer hobbyist, that was one thing. But if you were a business person or a university professor needing to exchange files with coworkers, you had to adopt the same operating standard they used. This is no longer the case, obviously, for consumer electronics. We have learned how to build open systems. It was said network externalities were pronounced in that domain, but now we have operating systems from Microsoft and Apple and Google and Linux all sharing the market. My argument then is that what is true of consumer electronics will soon be true of international finance. Once upon a time, there was room for only one international currency, the dollar. But now, because switching and interchangeability costs have fallen, the technology of finance has progressed. There is room in the world for several global currencies. We're heading, in other words, toward a world in which several currencies will share the international stage. And I will suggest, ultimately, that this change is to be welcomed. If you want my explanation for the financial crisis through which we have just passed, in a sentence, it would be that there was a dangerous inconsistency or a tension between our increasingly multipolar global economy and our still dollar-dominated or dollar-centric monetary and financial system. I think we are now moving toward a new world where there will be a better match between the real economy and its monetary and financial system, and that world will be a financially safer one than the one through which we have recently passed. So I've gotten this far in my talk about a world of multiple international currencies without naming them. So that's what I will do now. What currencies am I talking about? Specifically, I attach the highest probability to three playing a significant global role, say, 10 years from now. The dollar, of course, the euro, and the Chinese renminbi. So here I pause to watch people's eyebrows go up around the room. I see reservations about this last statement. Different people are questioning whether one of these currencies will be ready for prime time as soon as 10 years from now. The problem being, of course, that different people at different tables have reservations about different ones of the three. Currently, I think it is fair to say that pessimism is most pervasive about the euro. Europe is in crisis, or at least Southern Europe, of which Ireland is an honorary member, is in crisis. It's not clear that that these countries, now being forced to impose draconian spending cuts, can recover without reintroducing their own currencies, so they can devalue those currencies and grow their exports. Keeping them in the euro area would require massive transfers from Germany and German voters, it is said, would rather abandon the euro themselves and reintroduce the Deutschmark than agree to this. My view, you will anticipate now, is that all this euro doom and gloom is overdone. While a debt default by Greece or a debt default by Ireland can't be ruled out, neither can a default by Los Angeles County be ruled out. But in the same sense that a default by Los Angeles would not mean the end of the dollar, a default by the Greek government would not mean the end of the euro. And I would be prepared to argue, I will be happy to argue during the Q&A, that a country like Greece would certainly make its problems infinitely worse by at the same time attempting to reintroduce the drachma. Germany, for its part, has both economic and political reasons not to want to see the euro collapse, not to contemplate reintroducing the Deutschmark. The economic reasons can be summed up in one word: exports. Germany has done so well in the last 10 years because of its export miracle, and a competitive euro has been part of that. A Deutschmark that went through the roof against the rump euro would not be consistent with that continued export success. And secondly, I think that Germany has too much invested in the larger European project to turn back on that now, which is what abandoning the euro would mean. So in the past, whenever European leaders have had their backs to the wall, they have figured out how to do the right thing financially. Jean Monnet, the father of European integration, said Europe is forged in crises. Well, they have a good one now, and I think they are about to figure out how to fix it. Their crisis fundamentally is a banking crisis, so they have to fix the banks. Important European banks, starting with Commerzbank, are now raising more capital, and the European Banking Authority has indicated that it will hold the banks to pretty demanding capital standards in the second set of stress tests, which are coming in a couple of months. With stronger banks, it will then be possible to restructure the unsustainable debts in Southern Europe. And everyone knows how to do that, although they haven't begun to talk about it openly. They will do a debt exchange like we did in conjunction with Latin America at the end of the 1980s. It was called the Brady Plan, and the head of the Paris Club, who oversaw the official part of that exchange, had the name of Jean-Claude Trichet. So the relevant people know how it's done. And once that process is completed, I think the euro will return to the international stage as a true rival to the dollar. Bringing me to the greenback, I'm sure you hear as much chatter about this as I do. The worry, of course, is that dysfunctional politics continue to undermine efforts to bring America's chronic budget deficits under control. Divided government, with the Republicans controlling one of the houses of Congress and the Democrats in the White House, doesn't make this any easier. When interest rates return to normal levels, which they presumably will someday, not too far in the distant future, debt service will account for something on the order of a quarter to a fifth of federal taxes, and the fiscal situation, as you know, only darkens after that. So that's what S&P was talking about on Monday when they issued a warning that the markets seem to have taken as bad news about the dollar. So I think the question is whether the U.S. will come to grips with these problems before things get out of hand, or whether there will be pressure on the Fed not to normalize the level of interest rates at the appropriate time on the grounds that that will only make the fiscal situation harder to deal with. The fact that foreigners now own a majority of U.S. Treasury securities will, I think, make it more tempting to go the inflationary route. But foreigners understand this perfectly well. And if they see the United States unable to solve its fiscal problem, they will dump their dollars. So that's the dollar crash scenario. I'm not predicting, but I'm painting a story for you where foreigners grow alarmed, they get fed up. Foreign central banks not only curtail their purchases of U.S. Treasury securities, but they start actively selling off part of what they already hold, at which point the dollar crashes. Treasury yields spike, important institutional investors are wrong-footed, very bad things happen. So to be clear, this is not my baseline scenario. I'm an optimist by temperament. I'm a patriotic American. I think our Congress and political class will get their arms around this problem before it's too late. But if they don't, that could spell the end of the dollar's role as an international currency. Finally, there are the challenges that China must surmount in order to internationalize the renminbi. It will have to build deep and liquid financial markets and make them accessible to foreigners. It will have to remove many of the financial restrictions that are integral to its development model. It will have to establish rule of law in order to reassure people like you and me that Shanghai is a safe place to invest. These are not processes that will be completed overnight. They are, however, processes, in my view, that can be completed in as short a period as 10 years. And I say this for two reasons. Number one, Chinese officialdom is intent on internationalizing the renminbi in that period of time. So they have declared that Shanghai will have been transformed into a true international financial center by 2020, that we will be able to do our international financial business there in less than 10 years. They see doing so as an important advantage for their own banks and firms. They see how American banks and firms can do business globally in dollars. They would like Chinese banks and firms similarly to be able to do business globally in renminbi. They're moving fast, and I think they're moving intelligently. So the first step in moving is to encourage firms to do their cross-border trade in China's own currency. And where no Chinese firms did cross-border trade in China's currency 2 years ago, something on the order of 100,000 do it now. So 7% of China's trade at last report is invoiced and settled in China's own currency. 7% is not a big number, but it's a whole lot bigger than zero. Important international corporations like McDonald's and Caterpillar have been authorized to issue renminbi-denominated bonds in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is the petri dish the Chinese use to test out financial innovations. What works now in Hong Kong will be permitted before too long in Shanghai. And the caboose on the train, the last step, is to encourage foreign central banks to hold renminbi as reserves. There has been a little bit of that, actually. The Malaysian central bank holds Chinese bonds already, but only a little bit. So we have committed the error of underestimating how fast China can move before. I would suggest that we shouldn't underestimate them again. My second reason for believing that you can actually complete a transition like this in as short a time as 10 years is that history tells us we did it. The dollar was not an international currency. It was not used internationally at all in 1914. The dollar accounted for 0% of central banks' foreign exchange reserves in 1914. 0.0% of international bonds were denominated in dollars in 1914. 0% of credit for U.S. imports and exports was in dollars in 1914. When a U.S. Importer wanted credit in order to import coffee beans from Brazil, he went to his local bank, which went to its correspondent bank in London, the financial center, and borrowed the credit in pounds sterling. So the dollar was not an international currency at all in 1914. It had already become the leading international currency, surpassing marginally the pound sterling by 1924. How did we do that? Well, we established a set of institutions to support international markets in the dollar. The Fed was created in 1914, partly as an effort to internationalize our currency. The Federal Reserve Act encouraged U.S. banks to branch abroad and originate international financial business. Importantly, the Fed provided liquidity to the market in what were called trade acceptances, the equivalent, I suppose, of CDOs, securitized trade credits, that the market in which grew very rapidly over that period. So U.S. history tells us it can be done. The full history is, of course, more complicated than that. Other things intervened between 1914 and 1924, like World War I, which didn't strengthen Britain's position. But I think the point carries over. If China is serious about internationalizing its currency, it can create the relevant market structure. If it succeeds, as I would expect, the renminbi can become a consequential international currency as soon as 2020. So for all these reasons, I think a global monetary and financial system organized around multiple international currencies, organized around the dollar, the euro, and the renminbi is coming. As I said before, I think this is an evolution that we should welcome rather than fear. There is no intrinsic reason why an international system organized around these three major currencies should be any more fragile or unstable than the system we currently have. Indeed, I would suggest that there are reasons to be hopeful that this new system will be more financially stable than the current one. Part of the problem that we've had in the United States is that we don't feel external financial discipline regularly or promptly. So when we were blowing our bubble between 2003 and 2006, foreigners continued to lend to us freely. U.S. interest rates were something on the order of 50 to 100 basis points lower than they would have been in the absence of foreign central bank purchases of dollars. Foreign central banks continued to purchase dollars as insurance, despite evidence that all was not well in the United States because they didn't have an alternative. In this new world I'm describing, there will be alternatives. If there is the perception of problems in the United States, it will be possible for people in other countries to do business and accumulate reserves in euros or Chinese renminbi, and conversely, if there are problems in other countries. So that's the sense in which I think a global monetary and financial system in which there is a better match between the monetary side and the real side will in fact be a safer financial place. So the good news is that, in my view, we can complete this transition in as short a period as 10 years. The bad news, if you will, is that economic history tells us that a crisis of one sort or another comes around every 3 years or so. So on that happy note, let me stop. I'm happy to take questions on all of the above and also to take the inevitable question about gold.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.